children on empathy, but I'm going to do the long version. I hope I do it as well as Kate did her short version. Here's a poem. It's called Judge Softly. It's not great writing, but it contains a good message and ends with a line that everyone is sure to recognize. Pray don't find fault with the man that limps or stumbles along the road unless you've worn the moccasins he wears or stumbled beneath the same load. There may be tears in his soles that hurt, though hidden away from view. The burden he bears placed on your back may cause you to stumble too. Don't sneer at the man who is down today unless you have felt the same blow that caused his fall or felt the shame that only the fallen know. You may be strong, but still the blows that were his unknown to you in the same way may cause you to stagger and fall too. Don't be too harsh with the man that sins or pelt him with words or stone or disdain unless you are sure you have no sins of your own and it's only wisdom and love that your heart contains. For you know, if the tempter's voice should whisper as soft as to you as it did to him when he went astray, it might cause you to falter too. Just walk a mile in his moccasins before you abuse, criticize, and accuse. If just for 1 hour you could find a way to see through his eyes instead of your own muse, I believe you'd be surprised to see that you've been blind and narrow-minded, even unkind. There are people on reservations and in the ghettos who have so little hope and too much worry on their minds. Brother, there but for the grace of God go you and me. Just for a moment, slip into his mind and traditions and see the world through his spirit and eyes before you cast a stone or falsely judge his conditions. Remember to walk a mile in his moccasins and remember the lessons of humanity taught to you by your elders. We will be known forever by the tracks we leave in other people's lives, our kindnesses and generosity. Take the time to walk a mile in his moccasins. Deborah, do you have something for us now that everyone will recognize or something new that's just as wonderful? Thanks so much for playing that. Don't judge someone until you've walked a mile in their moccasins. You've probably heard that expression before and may have assumed or been told that it's an old piece of Native American wisdom. I'll judge you softly for thinking that because I used to think the same. There's no reason to think that the author of the poem was trying to create a false impression. She published Judge Softly under the name Lena, but her real name was Mary Torrens Lathrop. And of course, I have the miracle of the internet to thank for helping me to discover that fact, and also that Lathrop was a leader in the Women's Christian Temperance Union. A powerful speaker known as the Daniel Webster of Prohibition, she was also a licensed preacher with the Methodist Episcopal Church. She pushed for the passage of scientific instruction laws that imposed anti-alcohol education in schools across the country, depicting alcohol use in terms very much like recent programs directed against crack cocaine and methamphetamine. Such teaching continued to be mandated in some states even after prohibition proved to be a massive failure that had led to gross excesses in policing and a huge increase in organized crime. As it was with the more recent anti-crack and anti-meth initiatives, it seems that the compassionate wisdom of trying to walk a mile in someone else's moccasins was soon erased by violent attempts to police a problem away. It can be tricky to live by the wisdom that we speak. Which brings me to another popular expression. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Some attribute these words to Albert Einstein or Mark Twain or to a founding father like Ben Franklin. Others think it's wisdom from a deeper past, further east, the words of a Chinese sage, Confucius, or maybe Lao Tzu. East or west, it must come from someone with whom we'd like to sit and talk, or maybe take a long, long walk in moccasins, sandals, or even barefoot, just so we could spend time with them. Thanks again to the magic of the internet, I learned that author Rita Mae Brown is the one who used those words for what seems to have been the very first time in her 1983 mystery novel, Sudden Death. I'd be happy to take a long walk with her sometime and hear more of her thoughts. Some call her a lesbian writer, but she rejects that label herself. Labels, particularly sexual identity labels, are mostly used to cut us down, make us less than we are, shove us into a locker. She says, "I love language, I love literature, I love history, and I'm not even remotely interested in being gay. I find that one of those completely useless and confining categories. Those are definitions from our oppressors, if you will. I would use them warily," says Rita Mae Brown. Excuse me. I imagine that she would also be wary about how voices from right, left, and center have all used her words about the definition of insanity as they argue with each other. Here's part of an August letter to the Oregonian from a Tigard resident who was feeling upset by the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that have been going on for so long in Portland. "I've watched the destruction of this city over the last 60 plus days, and I'm so angry that city officials are continuing to let this nonsense continue. Isn't doing the same thing night after night with the same bad result the definition of insanity? How can you be okay with riot behavior every night? Also, our police are prevented from fulfilling their duties and are being vilified. These people put their lives on the line every day for everyone. I'm thankful I don't live in Portland. I'm just outside looking in, but it's disgraceful and embarrassing. I've lived in Portland and surrounding areas for 50 years. I used to love this city and now I can't wait to get out. I know many other people who feel the same way, but what can we do? If we openly criticize, we are persecuted for having a voice that doesn't agree with those who are louder. I don't expect my comments to make a difference to city officials, but I can't be silent." Well, speaking out isn't easy, nor is it really safe. "I know many other people who feel the same way, but what can we do if we openly criticize? We're persecuted for having a voice that doesn't agree with those who are louder." Let's take a moment to walk in the writer's shoes and acknowledge the courage it took to sign their name. Newspapers do still require signatures and hometown identification on letters to the editor. But yes, thanks to the magic of the internet, which has no such requirements, they could be exposing themselves to doxing attacks that reveal their phone number and home address, the names of their kids, and the place where they work, and of course, to physical danger. But back now to the writer's questions. Isn't doing the same thing night after night with the same bad result the definition of insanity? How can you be okay with riot behavior every night? I think these are fair questions, though I might put them in different words than those borrowed from Rita Mae Brown or those that echo Donald Trump. I think the main question is one that many of us have been asking. Why is it that these demonstrations have kept on going for so long? Why now, when we've never seen this happen before? Is it more than the obvious fact that so many of us are stuck more or less at home with plenty of time to watch the news and the horrific videos over and over again so that the message that Black Lives Matter has begun to finally sink in? Let me start by repeating some words that we've heard before, words spoken in gasps by George Floyd, by Eric Garner, by far too many other human beings as the life has been choked out of them by police officers. I can't breathe. Do you think it's an accident that these words have at last been taken to heart by a majority of Americans and by many thousands of people in other countries at a time when over 215,000 Americans have died because a virus have left them unable to breathe? Another's moccasins or another's lungs. We're starting to get it. At any moment, I might be next, or you might be, or your parents, your life partner, your kids. And this has come to pass in no small part due to the misuse of authority and trust, inaction where there should be action, the spread of misinformation or disinformation instead of facts, the sowing of mistrust at a time when we need confidence in each other more than ever before by an angry and resentful leader. Peter and his cronies, whose only concern seems to be with asserting and holding on to power. I don't mean to diminish what was done to George Floyd or so many others when I say that I have had a hard time breathing for almost 4 years now, and I know that I'm not alone. Even before the demonstrations began, people have begun interacting with each other in what feel like new ways, acting more like college roommates, you could say. We walk differently, stepping off the sidewalk or crossing to the other side of the street when others come our way, acknowledging as best we can that, like new roommates, we're all in this strange new thing together. As the demonstrations began, we were already not quite the same people we'd been some months before. Breath and life and language were being reimagined. How are you? Has come to mean, how are you breathing? How are you holding up as you walk this narrow bridge between breath and life and death? We recognize at long last, and at least for a little while, that we are really together in something. In something. Hallelujah. Besides breath and death, there's also bread, a word that can refer to food or money. Many are now facing radical economic uncertainty about employment, paying the rent, buying basics such as food, than at almost any other time that most of us have known. Right now, we are sharing to some extent what has been a daily, long-standing uncertainty in many minority communities for as long as anyone can remember, a daily concern about bread. This takes me back to an earlier time. The war in Vietnam was still raging when I faced the military draft. Student deferments had been abolished, and I joined millions of young men of all races and classes, anxiously waiting to learn what our lottery numbers would be. While not exactly equal, our chances of being drafted were much more even than they had been before. Excuse me. This helped lead to a sense of solidarity among young males and many others that in hindsight resembles what we've been experiencing with COVID-19. Still, a very large portion of anti-war demonstrators were college and university students. In those days, most dormitory rooms, colleges, were much less cushy than what you find today and much less well-equipped than what most students had left behind at home. Dorm buildings and student apartments tended to be very crowded and or very old. My freshman dorm, in the year I faced the draft, was built around the middle of the 19th century and had been upgraded only once. There were still fireplaces in every room, though they had been decommissioned. Heat now came from turn-of-the-century radiators that would hiss or bang all night, and two or three roommates shared two or three electrical outlets at most. The plumbing was dodgy and prone to failure, like that in so many buildings in the impoverished neighborhoods surrounding our university. Porcelain sinks were rust-stained and drained slowly, and I should probably not even mention the toilets and shower stalls. I should certainly not tell you the story of what started one night with a drinking party on my floor, but continued long, long after. One young man had had too much and lost it in the shower stall before he could get his head over a toilet. For weeks thereafter, anyone showering in that stall had to be quick, or else the remnants of that young man's bad experience would back up over your toes to become your bad experience. A much grosser version of walking a mile in someone else's moccasins, and a contributing factor in my becoming a teetotaler. Yes, sure was. For weeks, no one dared to complain about the drain, fearing that they'd be blamed or punished for it. Not an uncommon experience, I'm sure, for tenants in the slum housing that surrounded our university bubble. Such experiences of an approximation of poverty conditions were almost certainly a factor in a sense of solidarity that many students at the time carried into the streets as they protested the war, the draft, police brutality, and yes, poverty itself. And yes, I know that there's a big difference between experiencing crappy student housing and experiencing ghetto life, just as there's a difference between being poor and being temporarily out of spending money, out of bread. It's a small glimpse of something much, much bigger, much more raw, and much more difficult, but it's a start. Like Lewis when he saw those fish, it's a start. Protest and pandemic may fit us like a pair of someone else's moccasins for yet another reason. We all must think much more carefully now about leaving our homes to shop, to exercise, to go for medical care. We have to wonder more than most of us ever did before, will I be safe? Will I be seen as out of place or asked to explain where I'm going and why? Will I be under surveillance at every moment? In some parts of the country, wearing a mask can mean you're viewed with suspicion. In others, it's the opposite. Someone is watching. That we can be assured of. This sense of constant scrutiny has been an all too familiar part of daily experience for far too long, for far too many of our neighbors, especially young Black men. And now many more of us have felt the pinch of something much too tight on our feet, something that brings too much attention to our faces. The appearance of Department of Homeland Security and other outside armed forces in Portland reminds us all that being arrested cannot always be something that we should accept calmly, without questions, without struggle, just to keep things going smoothly. Who is this arresting me, this heavily armed person? Is he really enforcing law, or is he here to punish or to hunt? Why the camouflage fatigues on city streets? Why should I trust him? A man with a gun is a gunman, and it's unwise to forget this fact, even if he wears a uniform that identifies him as city police. A man with a gun is a gunman, and a group of gunmen wearing camouflage clothing, helmets, and goggles like members of a right-wing militia wearing no identifying marks who throw you into an unmarked van with no explanation have little reason to expect cooperation except what you do for self-preservation. To be fair, I don't think our letter writer was thinking of these invading forces when complaining that, quote, our police are prevented from fulfilling their duties and are being vilified. These people put their lives on the line every day for everyone. But I get the writer's point. It's important to remember that police are human beings, have families, have kids who go to the same schools as ours when schools are open, and have the same problems distance learning if they lack computers or a decent internet connection. They do have very difficult, very risky jobs, and they are coping with actions by some who arrive each night to do little more than raise hell. Please spend some time in these blue moccasins too. It's a good reminder, yes. But I imagine that many demonstrators do keep this in mind. Why would showing up at a demonstration against certain police behavior necessarily mean that one feels nothing for police as human beings? And why would serving on the police force mean that you care nothing for demonstrators or the concerns that they express? So many moccasins to try walking in these days. But isn't it something how people keep showing up to do it? Is this really a matter of doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results? Or does it better resemble another much older and perhaps much wiser saying, if at first you don't succeed, try, try again? We all know that one, don't we? Why do we know it? Why do we know it? Because we've heard it and heard it again and again. It models what it teaches. Repetition is powerful. It's how we learn to tie our shoes and how we learn to speak and sing. It's how truth is taught and also lies, and how lies can be unlearned bit by bit. It's what we do together on Sundays, week in and week out. It's why we have an order of service that we very slightly sometimes, but mostly keep the same. It's why we keep a copy of our principles on the back of that order. Principles like justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. Repetition is how we remember things like this. If we were to forget them, if we were to ever forget them, that would be the very definition of insanity. Stay well, stay true, and stay as safe as you can.